So welcome to the fourth day of our meditation retreat, and for this morning's talk I wanted to focus on the subject of insight. And usually I don't talk about that till later on in the retreat, but because of the questions which we've had on some of the evenings, I thought I'd clear up some of those discussions by talking about what actually insight means in the context of Buddhist practice. And the reason for this is that some people still think there's two different traditions of meditation in Buddhism, and sometimes they call it insight meditation and calm meditation. But that's never how I understood things as a young Buddhist, as a teacher now, as a disciple of Ajahn Chah. Those two are always the same. But there is a controversy there amongst some groups, and I wanted just to focus on that first of all, and actually where is this all coming from? What did the Buddha actually say about this, and why is there a controversy to begin with? But not just to make this a theoretical discourse, to actually explain afterwards exactly why, what actually is insight, and why do you need these jhanas to get the insight which creates enlightenment? What's the purpose? How does it work? So the talk this morning is on insight. But first of all, that again, in my own journey as a Buddhist, when I first became a Buddhist, the insight meditation, what's called Vipassana, was very getting to be well known. It's about 35 years ago. And even in London, people were teaching that meditation. I was practicing it as well. But later on, when I went up to Cambridge, there was another teacher there, and I was very fortunate, very good karma, to have somebody who was teaching jhanas, even when I was a student. That first retreat which I talked about in the boarding house, that was a jhana retreat. And it was amazing that there was somebody who was actually teaching that so long ago. And I managed to get on those retreats. It was an important part of me becoming a monk. But at the same time, like being a student, being brought up in a Western tradition, you're always encouraged to question and to challenge. And of course, I was always arguing with my teachers at school and also with the professors at university. In the school I went to and also the university I went to, that was encouraged. You were meant to do that. You were praised for that. And you're never criticized or pushed away as being sort of conceited, arrogant. Because it was more important, according to my teachers, this is at school and university, that you discovered how to find out, to learn, rather than just be told a series of facts which you have to just repeat at an examination. You're encouraged to investigate, to question, to find out. And so that was actually my upbringing, to always question, to probe, and never take anything on authority unless it was backed up with solid evidence. And so when I give talks around the world and I start saying there are two types of religion, the one which bends the faith to fit the facts, the other one which bends the facts to fit the faith. This is actually part of my upbringing. You can't actually take some teachings and just believe in them just because your teacher says so, or because the book says so, or because it makes sense according to reason. Because some of those things, they just aren't reliable. Sometimes what you think is reasonable today, you found out afterwards you just made too many assumptions. It was actually unreasonable. You made mistakes. So being devoted to finding out the truth, being able to challenge, being encouraged to challenge, it was very reassuring to find a teacher like Ajahn Chah, who, even though he was an Asian of that tradition where you are supposed to follow what your master said, that he was one of a kind, because he also encouraged questioning and challenging. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why he had most Western disciples, more Western disciples than probably any other Asian teacher of our generation. Certainly he had the most Western disciples. And I think because you could go up to him and say, I don't agree with this, and say, why? And then you'd say your piece, he'd argue back at you, you'd argue back. And in the end, with Ajahn Chah, his final line was, are you sure of that? Have you got no doubt? And if I said, or any other monk said, yeah, I've got no doubt at all, he said, good, go ahead and do it. There was always his last statement. If you were sure of your ground, if you'd had no doubt, then follow that, even if it disagreed with him. Because that way you'd find out for yourself. And Ajahn Chah, obviously, he wanted you to learn rather than just to believe. And of course, in the West, we all know the Kalama Sutra. We always got a question. You don't have to follow tradition. You don't follow what the teacher says. You don't do it just because it makes sense or because you like that type of teaching. You always have to really probe and investigate, which is what insight is supposed to be doing. Challenging, questioning, and finding out. So when I came back to Australia about 23 years ago to help start off this place here, that my meditation by that time was very, very strong. And so that I knew exactly what my mind was up to and how it was working and how insight came along, and I did very well in my meditation progress from that time. However, another event which was quite important to me, a small little event but which changed a lot of things, was a visiting monk came along one day, and some of you know that monk, it was actually Ajahn Titignano, and he'd been travelling around as a French monk of our tradition. He'd been travelling around and he'd been staying in Sri Lanka, and he said, you know, when I first went to Sri Lanka, because in the Thai forest tradition we didn't really do much study at all, we didn't know any Pali, just enough to chant with, that's all. And he said the monks couldn't believe that there was a monk of so many years who couldn't understand Pali, because that's just, you know, even the small novices know Pali in Sri Lanka. And he said it was humiliating, and so he said, just in passing, you should learn Pali. And so, you know, I had a good brain, and it's not hard to learn. You can do it yourself if you really apply it. And so I did learn Pali. And what happened when I learned Pali, and then he had all the books there, so let's start reading the sutras in Pali. And that's when just so many things just came up, like bright neon lights, things which I was thought was Buddhism. But then when you actually read what the Buddha actually said, so many things just, you realize that, you know, it's almost like a fraud. That people are telling you things which just weren't in the books, which the Buddha never said, which weren't true. And I've already mentioned one of those things, you know, in what was supposed to be, what I heard when I was a young Buddhist student, that Satipatthana was the most important sutta, was all about meditation. That's not true. There's so many other great teachings on meditation. And mentioned already when it said the Satipatthana said this is the only path, I looked, that's not true, that's not what that word means. And I mentioned earlier that when you read the sutras yourself, especially if you can learn a little bit of Pali and look exactly what the Buddha said rather than the translations, which when you translate you can always add a little bit of a twist here, a little bit of a twist there. When you read it in the Pali though, it's just so absolutely clear that the path to enlightenment is always the Eightfold Path. And that's repeated again and again and again and again and again and again. So much so that after you read those suttas, at least you can actually say for sure, as far as the Buddha taught, the Eightfold Path is the way to enlightenment. Not another way. And that's very, very clear. And also part of that path, the eighth factor, you know what the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is? It's, you know, Samma Samadhi. Sometimes people translate it as right concentration, but again, some of those translations are not all that helpful. Concentration always gives the idea of like force, you're concentrated, because that's what you did at school, you concentrated. But for these days, some years ago I said sustained attention, which was much closer than concentration. In other words, you've got something there, you can keep your attention on it for a long time. But much better than that, the word I'm using now, which is accurate to the original Pali, is like stillness. And we actually use the word stillness for samadhi or concentration, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. It's a brilliant word, because not only does it describe what meditation reaches and what samadhi is, the stillness of the mind where nothing is moving, but it also reveals how you attain those states of samadhi. Because when you get the right description of the goal, the path becomes much clearer. You exactly know how to get there because you know what it is like when you get there. So it makes it very clear every time you do something, every time you shake your mind by striving, doing this, wanting that, or not liking it, you are disturbing the stillness of your mind. And those of you who haven't seen this simile before, last couple of years I was teaching this simile. See this glass of water. Is it still? Now those of you, Lali, you in the front there, is it still?
No.
Okay, I'm going to try harder. I'm going to concentrate. The Western word of it, concentrate. Is it still yet? Still moving. I can try this for hours, for days, for years, trying to concentrate my mind to hold this glass still. But Dr. Bander will tell you at the back there, the muscles of an arm are constantly working. To actually hold this here, you cannot just be still. It's absolutely impossible to hold muscles still. So how can I attain stillness for this glass of water? It's very simple. Now look at it, Lali. It's moving even more right now. But give it one or two more seconds. That's stiller than I could hold it, but it's still vibrating slightly. Now it's actually almost perfectly still. Now that is a brilliant simile of what meditation or samadhi is, and also how to achieve it. When I call it stillness, it's very clear if you hold something, you can never keep it still. The same if you hold your mind, or hold your breath, or those of you who have nimittas, try and hold your nimitta, it will never be still. Because the nature of holding is always moving, disturbing. But if you put something down, when you first let go, it moves even more. Which is why that people don't have enough courage to let go. Because as soon as they let go, sometimes your mind goes crazy. More thoughts, more sleepiness. Which is why I encourage you to be patient. And start saying, sleepiness, restlessness, it's okay. As long as you're letting go. Because after a while, it settles down by itself. And it becomes absolutely still. Now that's samadhi. The stillness of the mind. Now when you actually start seeing this in the books, you understand that it's, when you say the Eightfold Path is the only way to Nirvana, it doesn't make sort of like Buddhism, sort of this elite religion, and you have to be a Buddhist to become enlightened. What it actually says is you have to practice a path to become enlightened. In other words, if you practice the Eightfold Path as a Hindu, as a Christian, as a Muslim, or just as an atheist, or whatever, as a neocon in the White House, it doesn't really matter what you think you are, as long as you practice that path, you know, you become enlightened. But that was actually the beauty of that teaching. It's not your belief as such, it's actually what you do, the path you travel. If you're a Mahayana and you have Bodhisattva vows, and you sort of want to put off your enlightenment, doesn't matter, if you follow the Eightfold Path, you will become enlightened. Cause and effect. When you actually start to see that, that was one thing which was very, very clear. And it was also just, it showed exactly what happened. They had this whole path of building up to Samasamadhi, the stillness, which was always, every time, page after page after page, was always defined as first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, or fourth jhana. That's all it was. So the Eightfold Path were always culminated in number one, two, three, and four jhanas. That's what was supposed to happen. That's what did happen. That was the culmination of the Eightfold Path. And after the Eightfold Path, that was the path, then you got the goal. The road is not so much the destination, it leads to the destination. It causes the destination to appear. But the destination was in the suttas, Sammo Vimutti and Sammo Vimutti Jhana. It was ninth and tenth factors. It wasn't a path, it was a destination. It was perfect freedom and the knowledge of that freedom. And as the insight came as a result of the jhanas. And again and again and again and again you saw this, that from samadhi, from that stillness, from the jhanas, you see things as they truly are. And I'm going to come back to that afterwards to explain exactly what we mean by seeing things as they truly are, rather than as they seem. Because this is where delusion comes from. When we look at something, when we hear it, when we feel it, even when we think about it, sometimes we assume that we're thinking in a straight line. We've got all the information and we're getting accurate conclusions. The point is, no. There's another force at work, a deluding force, which you can't see, your habitual tendencies of wanting and denial, and they actually bend the truth to suit you. So it's very, very difficult to trust even the evidence of your senses, even what you hear, what you see. Most of it is not what was actually happened. You only see a part of the experience. You literally see what you want to see. Everything else you just don't see. You only hear what you want to hear. Everything else you block out. Even what I'm saying over now, you're only receiving a small fraction of what I'm saying. Only what you want to hear, what makes sense to you, what feels important to you. There's this great experiment done in Harvard many years ago, where these psychologists, one of them went to interview a student, not actually interview, but they posed as being just a visitor to the campus. And they went up to one of the students there and asked the way to the architectural department or somewhere. And before the student could answer, two workmen rudely walked right between the two people, the questioner and the one being asked the question, with a huge door. But after the door had passed through them, then the questioner asked the question again, where's the way to the architecture department? And the student said, no, over there. But what had happened, it was all planned, when the door went between those two people, the original questioner, one of the psychologists, the original questioner, went along with the door and was replaced with another person. So the first person who asked the question was not the second person who repeated the question. And the whole purpose of the experiment was to see if that student actually noticed that the same question was asked by a different person. And they never noticed. Very, very rarely. So the first person would ask the question, where's the architecture department? The door would come between them. Oh, I'm sorry, where's the architecture department? Oh, over there. Two different people ask that question. And sometimes they change it around. A man, a woman, an Afro, a Caucasian. And the people didn't know. Now the point is, the psychology is, when someone asks you a question, you don't give a damn who that person is. That's not important to you. The only thing you focus on and you remember is the question itself. Now it just is a well-known experiment which just shows just how, through efficiency or laziness, and there's very little difference between the two of those, efficiency and laziness, whatever we see or hear, we only take out what we think is the important details. And very often we manufacture the rest to suit ourselves, what we think should be there. Now because of that, it's called like delusion. And this is one of the most important things which stop you being enlightened, and which jhanas knocks out. But going back to even the Satipatthana Sutta, that was always taught to me when I was young, is that that's the Vipassana tradition. That, you know, Vipassana equals Satipatthana. But check that out for yourself. When I read it for myself, hang on, that's not what it says. Because I mentioned earlier that if you just read, you know, even the English translation, it's good enough. Anyone who practices anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath, in everything which I'm teaching here, in exactly this way, the Buddha said, you fulfill and complete, you perfect the practice of Satipatthana. That's not just in one sutta, that's in a couple of suttas. It's repeated. So if anything, anapanasati is Satipatthana practice. But somehow or another, Satipatthana is vipassana, anapana is samatha. That's wrong. That's not in the suttas at all. That's not what the Buddha said. But what actually happened was that everybody knew that jhana was the way to enlightenment. The Buddha said that so many times. And it's also that, I never mentioned yesterday, that people say, oh, that jhana was known by other traditions of that time. You can check in the 10th sutta of the Digha Nikaya. I just remembered it this morning. The 10th sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the Subha Sutta, where the Buddha says, I do not see these jhanas perfected in any other tradition. That's straight from the word of the Buddha. There wasn't any jhanas before the time of the Buddha. Now the point is that that path actually led somewhere very powerful. And the reason why the Satipatthana Sutta is part of the Samatha Vipassana together is, again, when I started reading this for myself. And I'm saying this because many of you have got enough experience of Buddhism and you've heard these suttas before. Some of you may not be familiar with them, but never mind, you can look at them later on. But the translation of the prologue to the Satipatthana Sutta was always, already mentioned that, you know, they said in the translation, you do practice of contemplating the body in the body, mindful, secluded, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. And I've already mentioned that this body in the body business was actually just a bad translation. But it's also, so is a bad translation, having put aside covetousness and grief for the world. Because to me that never made any sense, even when I was a layperson. What do you mean covetousness? At that time I had a girlfriend. Yeah, I liked my girlfriend, but I didn't covet her. Sure, I had my green velvet trousers, but you know, it was just trousers, and wasn't coveting them. And grief? Yeah, my father had died a few years before, but I didn't have any grief. So I thought, oh, I'd done that already. I put aside covetousness and grief for the world. I was just an ordinary bloke. But that's not what it meant. The whole thing, when I became a monk, I said, what does that actually mean? Put aside covetousness and grief for the world. Do you understand what it means? But when I actually saw it in the Pali, it's Vinaya Loke Abhijja Dhammanasang, and I started reading sutta after sutta, and something started standing out, became as obvious as a police car in a traffic jam. It was very clear that Loke Abhijja, this first word, was a synonym, it was an alternative to the first of the five hindrances. For those of you who know a little bit of Pali, the first hindrance is karma, chanda, sensory desire. But sometimes, maybe about 40% of the time, they use a different word, loka abhija. And when I read that, I said, hey, this is that first term in the Satipatthana. It was very clear. So, in the Satipatthana, what it means is having put aside the first hindrance. And the Dhammanasa, in only two suttas, but it's there in two suttas, very clearly, that's an alternative for the second hindrance, for ill will. So actually, if you are going to translate those two terms properly, the original translation was done by Professor Rhys Davids over about 100 and something years ago, and it stuck. It's about time it was changed, and should be changed accurately with honesty, that it's having put aside the first two hindrances. When I checked out the commentaries, that's precisely what the commentary says. The commentary goes even further when it says, in Pali, when you have the first two of a well-known group, the rest of the group are included. And that's actually quite reasonable, because that's what they do elsewhere. With either a long group of which always goes together, the first two is meant there to signify the whole group. It's just like idiom, how Pali works. So the commentary said what they mean there is the whole five hindrances. So Satipatthana became having put aside the five hindrances. Then you do body contemplation. Then you do mind feeling contemplation. Then you do mind contemplation. Then you do Dharma contemplation. You've got to put the five hindrances aside first of all. When I saw that, and you can check it out for yourself, question, argue, you'll find actually that is why people who do Satipatthana, or they think they're doing Satipatthana, never fulfill the promise of the Buddha, which says if you do this, you get enlightened within 7 days. It's why we have 9-day meditation retreats, you know, 1 day to settle in, and 7 days to become enlightened, and 1 day to enjoy it afterwards. But how many people get enlightened after these retreats? And sometimes people do 1 retreat, 2 retreats, 10 retreats, 100 retreats. In fact, the first time I read the Satipatthana Sutta was done by Bhikkhu Soma a long time ago. And in the introduction, he said that he heard about this Satipatthana teaching by Maharshi Sayadaw. He went all the way over to Burma. He practiced for about 2 weeks. And he said he stood way over 7 days. He still wasn't enlightened. He didn't know what was going wrong, so he thought he might as well translate the book and publish it instead. And that's what he said. Now, the point to me was, look, the Buddha doesn't lie. He's doing something wrong there. And it's, again, you're not following the instructions. The five hindrances have to be put aside, first of all. Otherwise, insight never happens. And this is actually why. It's because already that what you see, what you feel, is not what's really there. It's bent to suit you. is this beautiful teaching of the Buddha, which shows why you need these powerful states of mind to see clearly. It's called the vipalasas. It's the distortion of the cognitive process. And again, when I came across this, you know, in the Pali, it's just brilliant teaching. Because the best brilliant teachings, they give you this insight which explains so many things. It's like all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle all come together. Oh, that's why. And it's very, very clear once you get a hang of it. And many psychologists and psychiatrists have got a handle on this. Because in psychiatry, it's wishful thinking and denial. The first two hindrances, the sensory desire, and the second one of ill will, that actually filters out. So you only see what you want to see, and you can't see what you don't like seeing. And that's very, very clear in the sexual relations between people. You see actually what happens. Why do you fall in love? If you were in your right mind, you would never fall in love. Basically, you fall in love because you want to. You have all these romances which you grow up with. You know, kids, when you're growing up, you read these girly books, you know, or you get the girly mags if you can get away with it as a young man. And all these romance stories, all the movies, always about romance, about boy meets girl, and then something happens. And just the different movies is just what happens in between. And in the end, they meet together again. Standard formula for a movie. And of course, when they all meet together again, they live happy ever after. Oh, it's just so wonderful. Because they stop there. They don't go on the day after the marriage, or the week after, or the year after. But the point is, we all know that. That's why you're laughing. It's true. But we don't want to know it. That's the trouble. And as you know, I've often said in my talks, even nowadays, to when you are out romancing, when you're looking for a partner in life, you go to the nightclubs, the candlelit dinners, or a walk under the moonlight. Why do you do that? It's because it's always so dark you can't really see what you're going out with. And you do that because in that darkness, your mind has full rein to actually to make that person you're going out with whatever you like. You know, they can be beautiful, the guy can be hunky, whatever it is, because you can't see clearly and the mind can imagine the rest. And that's even what we do when we look for a partner. Now why do we do that? It's because we want to. And it's all, whenever you get fall in love, it's always wishful thinking. You are crazy. That's why they always say that love is blind. It has to be blind. If you had your eyes, you would never do it. That's why they also say if love is blind, then marriage is an institution for the blind. This is the same, even with sex. Is sex fun? That's great. It's great when I wrote this in my little book. So, you know, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. Everyone, given half a chance, would want some sex. But is it really fun? And you know, I was a lay person before, so, you know, I wasn't born a monk, so I know what I'm talking about. People say, yeah, it's really great fun. You have the orgasm. It's wonderful. Just really great joy. How much of that is real? And how much is just a fulfillment of expectations? It's not actually what you're really experiencing, but what you think ought to experience. Because sex has got this incredible PR job. Talk about spin doctors. That's got the biggest spin in this whole world. Sex is fun and good. I already mentioned, I love challenging things. I like asking those deep questions which everyone else said, of course it's fun, of course, it's obvious. Is it? Now it's fascinating when you ask those two questions, because actually I read in the sutta that Buddha told Ananda exactly the same what I just said. He said, no, it's a perversion of your perception. You're not seeing clearly. You're in completely control of the hormonal delusion that this is enjoyable. It's so tense and tight, you can never really relax. It gives you a sort of pleasure, a burning pleasure of intensity. But is that really fun and happiness? It's like when I first took my first drink of beer. Again, only a 14-year-old, breaking the law. I got into trouble when I told this story at Nollamara, because some of the Sri Lankan parents says, "You're encouraging our children to break the law because they look up to you as an example." I said, "Okay, as long as they become a monk afterwards, that's fine." But, you know, it's just what you do as a young man. You know, you're pushing the boundaries, you know, you're sort of testing yourself out. So I went in the pub with one of my mates, you know, pretending to be sort of, you know, fully 18. And the pub must have been really desperate for business because they never asked any questions. And so he had a half a pint of beer. And there I was, the big guy, having my first pint of beer. It's disgusting. It tasted terrible. And as soon as, I couldn't admit that to my friends, I would say, "Oh, this is really good." But afterwards, I was so surprised that people were just making such a huge thing about beer when it tasted like piss, literally. Sometimes people actually call it that in Australia. It tasted disgusting. But the peer pressure was so strong. That was part of, you know, Western culture. Now, you had to go out with your friends and have a beer or go to a party and drink beer. The pubs were all over the place. There's far more pubs than churches in any city of England. And it was, you actually gave directions. When you asked how to get somewhere, you say, "You go to the Rose and Crown and turn left at the White Horse." You know, anyone's been in England, you know that. That's how you find your way around, by the pubs. And even when, after I'd been a monk in Thailand, I went back the first time, I noticed that many churches had actually closed down because Christianity was declining in England. The churches had closed down, but all the pubs were still there. Not one pub had closed down. Which actually showed, but the pressure was there to like it. And it only took me 6 months, and I liked beer. And I always remember that. I liked beer because I had to. The pressure was on. And it really started making me interested in just what's reality and what is completely conditioned into you. And I mentioned in one of the interviews, and I'll mention it again many, many times, even things like grief, when you lose a loved one and you go to their funeral, that's all conditioned into us to cry. Because I've been to so many funerals, I've got to go to one this afternoon, so I won't be here for lunch. I've been to so many funerals where these kids have come in, full of life, you know, 4 or 5 year olds, playing around, being as naughty, because that's what kids are like, and being told off by their parents. And they're looking up at their parents and seeing their parents are so sad and so much suffering, and see fear in those kids' eyes. What the heck is going on? Why is mummy and daddy in so much pain when they're just full of life? They learn to be sad at a death. Completely conditioned result. And sometimes you question exactly what is real and what's not real, to find out what's really truth and what's not truth, to get insight. And because so much of what we believe is true, we've been brainwashed into thinking like this by our culture, by our religion, by our teachers, by people like me. You've got to question, and never believe. Otherwise, all the insights which we get are not ours. We're just basically seeing what we've been told to see. And it's not real. It's just another illusion which is being spun. As soon as I heard that, it made me quite clear why you can go to a revival meeting at a Christian church and everyone can feel God. Why do they do that? It's because they're expected to. The peer pressure is on. And they do. But is it real? Of course it isn't. Or is it you can go to a soccer match? Or, let's say not soccer, test match is coming up soon. Australia versus England. Because of the media hype, even the monks know what's going on. And sometimes you get excited. Why? It's only a blooming cricket match. It's a big deal. There's so many important things going on in this world. What are you wasting your time for? But you really get sucked into it. This is actually how we get conditioned. Not to see what's really there, but to see what we want to see. To fit in. But it's also, we've got the denial as well. The things in life which are just too uncomfortable. We don't want to see them. Therefore we don't. Remember this lady who was used to come to our Armadale group. Big trouble one day. So a friend said, look, you've got to talk to her. Don't care how busy you are, because she's in a big trouble. So when I talked to her, I found out what had happened. Her husband had sexually abused her two kids. The school had found out, so the husband had been taken away to remand. The two kids and her were under a psychologist. Her whole life had unraveled. She still loved that man, but she loved her kids. So she was torn. And also, her guilt was so great. How did I let this happen in my own house? My husband was sexually accusing my two twins. And when I started talking to her, it was a great lesson for me, good for her. I said, of course you couldn't see it, because it was just so awful for you to see. It's denial, it's natural. Imagine that was you. You know, your partner, who you love dearly, have such a good time with. And you've got your kids as well, and you find your partner has been doing something just so cruel, so offensive, you know, to other people you know or you love. You'll just block it out. You just cannot see it. It cannot be true. Because it hurts so much to face up to it. It's a classic case of denial. The teachers saw it. It was plain for them. But the mother couldn't see it. It's obvious why. Because it hurts so much. It's the same way that if you're in a relationship and it's busted up. When your wife comes up to you one day, I want a divorce. What? We're having such a good time together. And basically your wife says, look, I've been telling you for the last couple of years. But you haven't seen it. Why? Because you didn't want to see it. It was just too painful to see. Or you go to the doctor one day and you've got this terrible cancer. Where did that come from? It was there all the time. But it's just such an awful thing to actually acknowledge. Say, no, it's not there, it's not there, it's not there. You're in denial, you just don't see what you don't want to see. And that's the problem with the perceptual apparatus we're given. Most of it is twisted and bent by the mind. So we only see what we want to see. We can never see what is just too challenging for us. So that's why if you really want to get the big insights, you can't trust the mind where the five hindrances, especially number one and two, desire, wanting, and number two, ill will or denial. You can't trust it when those two are in full operation. Nor can you trust the mind when there's sloth and torpor, because you're in the mist, but we all understand that. That's taken for granted, that when you're sleepy, you just can't see clearly, you don't trust whatever you see in a dream, or even when you first get up in the morning. The same with restlessness. You're not still enough to see clearly. And the standard metaphor for that, which I passed over earlier and I'm going to say again now, the road up to my monastery, again, going up and down that road for 9 years in a vehicle, one day I decided to walk up that 2.16 kilometers from the bottom of the hill to the monastery. When I started walking, I could not recognize the scenery. It was like walking up that hill for the very first time in my life. Which shocked me, because I've been up and down that hill for 9 years. That's where I live. And I stopped still. I stared, and then the hillside changed again. It's a great metaphor, because afterwards it was such a striking experience. I reflected about it afterwards. What did it mean? It became very clear that when you're looking through the window of a speeding car, the light doesn't have time to form a proper image on your retina. You get an image, another image comes up, dislodges the old, another image comes up and dislodges the old, it doesn't fully form. Remember, when light strikes the retina, it's a chemical reaction. And those chemicals have to come out in sufficient quantity for a colour to appear. Which is why at night time, because there's not much light, you don't see colour, all you see is just black and white. It needs intensity. And if you manage to stay long enough, that intensity builds up and the colors become richer. You see more detail and the mind has a time to explore the image which you see. So when I was looking through the window of a car, the colors were pastel. They were dull. And there was no detail there. But the point was, I thought I knew that hillside. My goodness, I've been up and down there in 9 years. That's where I live. Of course I know my surroundings. And it was a shock to realize it was quite a reasonable, rational explanation of why I'd missed so much. Because I was going so fast. When I stopped, only then did the light have all the time it needed to form a still image on my retina and for the mind to be able to explore it and see all its details. And that was the only time when I could really understand that hillside. And it was really beautiful as well. I missed so much. The colours were deeper. The detail was more fully formed. You spotted things you've never seen before. That's why when you're restless, when you're going so fast, you can't see clearly. You think you can. You may have been 60, 70 years old now. You think you know life. If you've been speeding through life, you still don't know. You need to slow down, to stop, to become still. It's why that restlessness is a great hindrance. It's why that in some traditions they say, oh, you don't need jhana, you just need what's called momentary concentration. That's a crazy idea. Not only is that nowhere to be found in the Buddhist suttas, but also it's what we call an oxymoron. You can't have momentary stillness. That's restlessness, momentary stillness. Momentary concentration is over here, over there. I'm concentrating on this, now I'm concentrating on that, now I'm concentrating on something else. If you did that at school, now you were sort of looking at one book, now you're talking to your friend, now you're asking a question, now you're playing with your Nintendo. Would you call that being concentrated? Sorry? ADD, yeah. Attention Deficit Disorder. That's momentary concentration. That's true, isn't it? Because if you're concentrated, you can actually read your book and you're there for a long time. It's sustained. If you're still, it means you're not moving, you're not going anywhere. That's so important to have that degree of stillness, because only then can you really see things as they truly are. It's the stillness of the mind when you're not moving. No sloth and torpor, the clarity of alertness. When I mentioned that the first talk, when you develop this method, you find you get more and more alert. The food, I hope by now, is beginning to taste more delicious. If it is, well done, enjoy it, because that means you're getting some stillness. That's a sign. You become more sensitive, you enjoy the garden more, you're just more awake, because the mindfulness is increasing. Sloth and torpor, and even its refined dullness, is disappearing, and you're alert. Mindfulness is strong enough to see things as they truly are. The restlessness has gone. You're not thinking all over the place. You can hold your mind on the breath or any object for long periods of time. It means you're still enough to see a full image. The ill will is not there. You're courageous. It doesn't matter if you don't like what you see. You're going to see it. No denial anymore. No ill will. Whatever you see, if I don't like this, doesn't matter, I'm going to see it. And desire, you have no vested interest in what you're going to find. It's no wishful thinking anymore. You want to see the truth as it really is. That's why you have to overcome those hindrances. The last one of doubt is jumping to the gun. Making assumptions before you've got all the evidence. Which again is one of the things which we do as human beings. We draw our conclusions too quickly. We figure out who's done it before we've read the whole book. When I tell a joke, people run ahead. They already got the punchline before I'm even halfway through. We never allow things to take their course. That what that doubt is like before the experiment is completed. Before all the data is in, we draw our conclusions and think that's the truth. We stick to that truth, even though other data comes in afterwards. Once upon a time, there was a little tadpole who lived in the pond. And when a frog came along and told him, you know, there's a place called dry land. And the frog said, what's it like? Well, said the tadpole, is it wet? No, it's not wet. Are there other fish in that dry land? No, there's no fish in that dry land. Is there any reed in that dry land? No, there's no reed. Any currents? No currents. Nah, I don't believe in dry land. It can't be. It's just one of these conspiracy theories. And of course, there's no way that tadpole could actually comprehend dry land because it's been born in the pond, lived all its life in the pond. That's all it knows. And it forms assumptions on the basis of its limited experience. That's what we do. That's why insight does not just need the power of the hindrances being gone. It also needs the fullest of data. And it happens quite naturally. One day the tadpole gets some legs and it crawls out. Ah! This is what that old frog used to say. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Frog. I really sort of bad-mouthed you and thought you were an idiot. But now I'm a big frog myself and I know what dry land is. And it's only then can the frog realize what dry land is. It's only when you get into jhana, when you've left the pond of the five senses, can you have an appreciation of what the old frog, the Buddha, I shouldn't call him an old frog, but just for the simile, was talking about all these years. Or the old frog Ajahn Brahm, that's even better. Because when you get into these jhana states, then, Four Noble Truths, everything is suffering. Do you accept that? Of course it's not suffering, I'm having a good time. Sort of, you know, a glass of wine after the meal, as long as it's not alcoholic. You know, watching the soccer, that's happiness. And having sex, that's fun. Whatever else it is you enjoy, watching Harry Potter movies, that's fun. Whatever else you think is joy, that's not suffering. Yeah, sure, divorce is suffering. Getting cancer is suffering. Going to hospital is suffering. Having a husband is suffering. Whatever else is suffering. But you always think that somewhere, someplace, there's some happiness. And that's me. That's where I'm going to go. So that's why a lot of people in religion, they look for what we call the ultimate retirement home. Some little corner or nook of this great samsara where you can be happy forever after. Whether you call that heaven or the pure land or the ground of all beings, some place where you can exist happy ever after. You know, the promise of the romance movies. In romance movies, the two of them, they rode off into the sunset, happy ever after. In religion, they went up into heaven and they lived happily ever after. It's just the same fantasy. It's only just religious instead of sexual. Or the person became enlightened and they were blissed out happy ever after. That's the Buddhist fantasy. Well, the Buddha is saying that a whole lot is dukkha, suffering. That's very clear what the Buddha says. Do you still want to be a Buddhist? No. That's because one hasn't understood it. The only place you can understand that is when you get into these jhana states. The reason is you're blissed out of your skull, the biggest bliss you've ever got in your life. It leaves sexual orgasm cold. This is real bliss, real pleasure. And anyone who gets into these states, this is before you get into those states, sometimes it's more bliss than you think you're going to explode. You don't think a human being can take so much pleasure. That's a description and personal experience of what happens when you get into these nimitta stages. They are powerful. Sometimes you think you can't take it anymore. It's just too much pleasure. But I'll tell you this, you can always take some more. And that's just before you get into the jhanas. So these are immense states. But afterwards, this is the data. And you use a mind which has got none of these hindrances to say, why? Why is that pleasurable? Because of the way that I've been trained, and the way I hope I'm training you, to ask questions, to be rebellious. Not just to take it and say, that was fun, but investigate. Why? This is what the insight is. Always asking those questions. looking, finding out, but using incredible powerful data and a mind which is free from the hindrances, which do not, well, the hindrances, free from the hindrances, so you're distorting nothing. You're seeing things as they truly are, not as you want them to be, not as you don't like them to be, but as they really are. You take those experiences and you think, the reason why that's bliss is because these five senses have completely disappeared. These senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching, is a pain in the butt. It is suffering, even to see your first child born, even to hear Beethoven's Fifth, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, even to experience the best of sex. None of that, none of that is even close to the bliss of when those five senses disappear. Even in their very highest, best and purest and most enjoyable form, they're still suffering. That does not make sense unless you've experienced those jhanas and have something to compare. You've got the extra data. Then you understand how you scrabble around this world looking for pleasure, looking for happiness, looking for something to enjoy, when you've got this incredible, powerful, I've told a few people, treasure chest which you're sitting on, and you neglect that of the stillness of the mind and going for second rate, not even second rate, third rate, fourth rate, fifth rate happinesses such as sex and movies. But of course, you won't stop watching those movies or having the sex, because that's the best you know. And all this is just theory at the moment. If you actually find it out. When I started talking about this once in Singapore, someone came up to me and said, please, 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 please don't talk about this, because I like my sex. But I want to be your disciple. So, do I have to give up sex to be a Buddhist? Please don't say I have to. And they were really concerned. I said, no, you're okay. But there'll come a time when you might get a jhana and you won't be interested in sex anymore. Ah, I don't want to get into jhanas. Listen, it's much better than sex, for goodness sake. It's not as if I'm taking away your pleasure, I'm giving you more, better pleasure. Oh, maybe that's okay then. Now the point is that this is actually what happens. This is an insight which is based on experience, which challenges you. And of course the other great, and I'll go into this in more detail later on, the other great thing is the nature of your mind. Because you've got these five senses, but you've got this sixth sense, which is the mind. And I've given a simile of the emperor. The emperor, which is clothed in these five garments. He's got this big helmet, which goes right over his head, over his shoulders. He's got a tunic, which is covered by the top of bottom of his helmet, goes to his wrists and halfway down to his thighs. He's got gloves, which cover his hands and go halfway up his arms. They cover the end of the tunic. Trousers, which cover the top of his bottom of his tunic, so that overlaps as well. And boots, which overlap the bottom of the trousers. So there's no part of the body which is visible, covered by the five pieces of clothing, the helmet, the tunic, the gloves, the trousers, and the boots. So no one knows who the emperor is. Is it a man or a woman? Is it maybe a cyborg? Is it African, Caucasian, Sri Lankan, Chinese, old or young? What is this emperor? Because no one ever sees it. And that simile, that emperor is like the mind. It's always covered with these five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. So you can never actually get to this mind. It's always covered with five senses. The only way you can actually find out what the emperor is to take off the clothing. Take off everything to see the emperor unclothed. That's a very good simile for how you understand what the mind is. To see it unclothed from the five senses. When you can take off the five senses, you're just left with the mind. And that's what happens in the jhanas. That's one of its purposes. To see what this mind truly is. Be face to face with it. For hours. Only then do you know exactly what this emperor is underneath all of you. And when you come to the Buddhist teachings like anatta, non-self, I meant it is easy to understand your body is non-self, even though that sometimes we attach to our body. But our mind, that's not me or mine, that's the tough one. Because you still think that you decided to come here. You still assume that you decide whether to sit, to walk, or go back to bed. That you choose whether to have toast or omelettes, and exactly how much butter or whatever else you put on your toast. That you think that you're in charge of that. That's an assumption which seems so obvious, that you're the one who wills. When you get into the jhanas, that assumption is obliterated. It doesn't stand any longer. You find you aren't in charge. Will is just a phenomena, but it doesn't originate from you. Now that is fearful. The reason is because you're letting go of one of your biggest attachments to yourself. And it's like dying, but dying big time. Not just your body dying, but your whole soul being obliterated. It's not being obliterated, it just wasn't there in the first place. So it's just a delusion is being broken apart. You're seeing the will is not you. And that cannot be seen without the jhanas. You just haven't got enough information. You're still in a pond. You haven't got out yet. You haven't got the data yet. When you go into those jhanas, my goodness, it's obvious. It's right there in front of you. You have to be a dummy to miss it. There still are dummies, but you go there again and again and again. Sooner or later you must see it. And then you see the last refuge of the sense of identity, the one who knows. The one who's looking at me now. The one who's listening to me. The one who is listening to your thoughts. The knower. Surely that's me. Can't I stay there, please? Please, Ajahn Brahm, let me still have the knower. Sorry, guys. But once you get to these jhanas, that knower fragments, fades away, and disappears. And you see that. You don't exist. All there was are these five khandhas, this process, this little automatic sequence of events, one conditioning the next, taking on this karmic process. That's all there is. From before that realization, that's scary. Afterwards, it's the biggest relief you could ever have. At last, realizing you don't have to worry about a thing. You're completely free. Because there's no one in there. Only then is there freedom. That's how insight happens. That's what enlightenment is. Seeing things as they truly are. Not just the small stuff, but the big stuff. That's why you do need the jhanas. The Buddha said that again and again and again and again. There is no such thing as just a path of wisdom or a path of samatha. The two types of arahats found in the suttas are those with the four jhanas and those with the four jhanas plus the arupa states, the immaterial attainments. All arahats have four jhanas. All anagamis, non-returners, have four jhanas. Have to, no other way. It's the Eightfold Path. So, develop these jhanas. They're not that hard, as long as you follow the instructions. Bliss out, get the biggest bliss of your life, and at the same time, the biggest insights of your life. The path is not, here's one of my favorite sayings, just comes to mind. The Buddha said, and this is actually in the word of the Buddha, this compilation of Buddha's sayings. The Buddha said that this is a path without groaning. There's a great saying there, without groaning. So if you're groaning, come on, you've missed the path. If you're suffering physically and working hard, it's not the path. This is the path without groaning, said the Buddha. So basically, so have fun. Take it easy. get happiness, get joy, let go, make peace, not war. Sit there, don't do anything. Stop groaning, smiling. And that is what creates the jhanas. And that's what creates enlightenment. And that creates the biggest bliss of your life. So there we have it. That's what insight is. According to the suttas, according to my experience. So what you're doing here is dinky-dye insight. But the big stuff. Not the small stuff. So, are there any questions on that?
Yeah. And I feel a little bit uncomfortable with the translation of suffering. Because I thought that dukkha is like the truth and natural process. For example, like birth, old age, illness, and death, that's a natural process. And then pain, for example, you have cancer. Because you are a human being or not really human being, even dog and cat have cancer. Because the body is deteriorating. It's not actually the suffering. It's just the natural process. Now, when you want it to get better, or when you want to do something about it, to reduce that pain or something like that, and that is the delusion. So I thought that, like for example, other thing that the dukkha is not, it's just like for example, if you make a dukkha as suffering, and then happiness is something with not dukkha like that, then I thought that was a delusion, when in fact it's just the truth of the process of that thing is just not.
Yeah, I think you're talking about, the Buddha actually said the three types of dukkha. Dukkha-dukkha, viparinama-dukkha, and sankhara-dukkha. The dukkha-dukkha is usually the only dukkha which people know. It's just the dukkha of pain, not getting what you want, birth, old age and death. Just the ordinary dukkha of life, which is what people can penetrate. They know, but they can't escape from very easily. We have viparinama-dukkha, which is the dukkha of change. When you're having a good time, you know it's not going to last. When I ask a person, how are you today? They say, fine, just as a joke, but also as dove, I say, that's not going to last. When somebody says, had a good meditation today, I said, that's not going to last. It's true, isn't it? Or as Ajahn Chah, you know, that famous saying, when I was in hospital sick with typhus fever, he came in and was very, very compassionate, and all he said to me, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. And then he left. Thank you very much. That's true, that's the dukkha of change. And that's the dukkha which people deny. But in the background, it's what causes worry and fear. Whenever you're having a good time, when you're in good health, your business is going well, you've got a nice relationship, you're in a nice monastery, having a great time, it's not going to last. That's the suffering of change. We know that. We deny that. But the last suffering is the big one, the sankhara, the suffering which is inherent in every conditioned thing. Which makes the idea of a heaven realm impossible. No matter how good you can make it, it's never going to be good enough. The point is, just even existence is inherently suffering. Now that is challenging, deeply so, because one of our innermost feelings is that life is good. It's just we somehow we got it wrong, that we are the mistake, not life. But the Buddha knew that life is flawed. So those people who commit suicide are half right. They don't know the way to commit suicide, that's a problem. They just kill their body and the mind carries on. Am I challenging you? Hope so, because this is actually when you see that the five sense world disappearing and the body going, and that's such a relief. Even if you're healthy and well, good relationship, having a great time, you feel that's still, compared to the first jhana, that's suffering. This is a great teaching of Venerable Sariputta. He said the five sense world, what we take as our life, is a sickness. But if you've been sick all the time, you can't notice that. When you get into first jhana, you realize that, wow, there was sickness all the time. Or like the Buddha's simile, it's like this blind man. He was walking down the street one day, and this merchant came along and selling beautiful white cloth from Benares. That was supposed to be the best cloth. And the blind man said, how much is it? No, because you're blind, a special offer for you. But this is beautiful white cloth, the very finest of cloth. And so the guy buys it. And sometime later, a doctor comes along with some magic medicine and he said, oh, I think I can cure your blindness. And he does. And as soon as the man gets his sight, he sees he's been sold a dirty old rag. This is not white cloth from Benares. He's been defrauded. Because he was blind, he just had to take on trust what that salesman said. And the Buddha said, you can see the simile there, when you're blind, we take on these five senses, and sex, and relationships, and having babies, and getting rich, and going to see the Great Wall of China, and seeing the movies. We take all that as, you know, beautiful white cloth, oh, this is so great and fun. But when you get your eyes, you've been sold a dud. Talk about dodgy brothers, car dealers. This samsara, Mara, he can teach a car dealer sort of tricks they never even believed could exist. Mara is the god of delusion. And you've been sold a dud. And you still think it's a beautiful white cloth. And Ajahn Bhav says, you know, you've been sold a dud. Say, no, what is Ajahn Bhav? It's just this stupid deviant monk, this celibate who doesn't know the real world. But if you look and get close to us, if your eyes get opened, the eyes of the mind, you find you've been sold a dud. Everything you thought was beautiful, joyful, wonderful, delightful in this world, it's just a dirty old rag. That's called insight. Opening your eyes and seeing what it says in the suttas, what the enlightened ones say is suffering. The ordinary folk say it's happiness. Well, the ordinary folk say it's suffering. The enlightened ones say it's happiness. Great saying. You got a question, Angela? Yeah?
Perhaps not for now, but sometimes would you be able to address how we would have an enduring, loving, procreating society if everyone
was in the job? Yeah, oh, you wouldn't. You just all become monks. And that would mean we have no more global warming, no more sort of using all these resources. But, so what do you want a great society for? Societies come and societies go, but the point is no one would. No one would do that. So I remember Ajahn Sumedho was asked a similar question. What happened if everyone became a monk? His answer was, what would happen if everyone became a dentist? There'd be no doctors, no street cleaners, no... Because you think it can't happen, it won't happen. But you can get into a jhana. What would happen if you get into a jhana? That's the most important question. The whole world won't get into jhanas. There's the Muslims, there's the Christians, they won't have a bar of it. So they can make the society, and we just, bye-bye society, you can look after it. Yeah?
Yeah.
Not all that time.
and then you walked up that path at Bodhijana and you saw some of this beautiful scenery. Hmm. What's the difference in the reality?
The reality of seeing the beautiful scenery, it was just more beautiful than I'd thought it could be. But it was the comparison between what I'd seen through a moving car and what I'd seen when I was still. That was the most important. Because it gave me an understanding, because it was shocking. I never expected that. And I always ask questions and try and find out why. And it was obviously a very easy answer, because it was just basic anatomy. But it also, it gave a wonderful metaphor for how you have to be still to see things. And also, the carrot, the incentive of when you're still, you get happy. whatever you taste is more delicious, whatever you see is more beautiful. But more than that, it shows if you really want to see things, you have to be still, but you can be even more still than that. Compared to the jhanas, that hillside is like a rubbish dump, even if it's most beautiful. There's always the comparisons. And this is why you, maybe I spent the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years just trying to get a person to get into jhanas. A few people have done that and they know what I'm talking about. But I want more people to get into those jhanas to experience it for themselves. And then you'll understand exactly what I'm saying, if it's true or if it's false. You'll understand what beauty is, what real happiness is, what freedom is. And then you do find you've been sold a dud. And all of those metaphors which I'm quoting from the suttas, they're there, and they're very clear. It's what the Buddha said. But unfortunately, that very often, very rarely do monks actually quote those metaphors. Because I think many of the monks believe they're in the dud robe as well, the dud piece of cloth. They haven't actually gotten to those jhanas and seen that, you know, the world of the sense pleasures is just that. The beautiful hillside is nothing.
Even Buddha said once, I think, that the wind that comes from his hometown is sweeter than nicer something.
Oh yeah. Wind that comes from your hometown is sweeter, but it's still pretty smelly compared to the jhanas.
So yeah. I mean, even after attaining that stage, he was able to enjoy the wind.
Oh yeah, you still enjoy the world which you're in, you still enjoy your food. But the point is that you know that there's something much more than that, so you don't get attached, you don't hold on to these things and celebrate them. The point is you have a different understanding, a wider understanding. Yeah?
Could you repeat the three
dukkhas,
please?
The three? Three, oh yes, it's the dukkha-dukkha, that's the ordinary dukkha, and it's viparinama dukkha, which is the suffering which is inherent in change. That's especially the case when you're having a great time, but you're worried. Yes, the word stop is a great word. So you can actually just say it to yourself, stop. And see how much you can stop. How still you can be. Stop thinking. Stop planning. Stop willing. It's a tough ask, but this is what we do. Yes, the word stop is a great word. So you can actually just say that to yourself, stop. And see how much you can stop. How still you can be. Stop thinking. Stop planning. Stop willing. It's a tough ask, but this is what we do. Little buddy, if you're sitting here, you stop and the whole world stops. I used to say as a young man, stop the world, I want to get off. This is how you do it. Stop. Stop, 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 stop. Okay, sorry.
Meditation.
Yeah.
Is there no momentary concentration?
No, there's no such thing as momentary concentration. It's a word which, if you investigate, does not have any meaning. It's a word which was never used by the Buddha, never once. You can check the whole Pali Canon. It's not there. It's called Kanika Samadhi. Not there at all. Sometimes recently they started saying vipassana jhanas. There is no such word in the suttas. It's a construct of other monks coming much later. Jhana is jhana is jhana. There's no. You can get into jhana by practicing this vipassana technique, fine. You can get into jhana by doing metta. You can get into jhana by anapanasati. You can get into jhana by doing kasinas. But once you get in there, it's exactly the same experience. The path in is different, but the experience is the same. Jhana is jhana is jhana. That's why waste of time calling it metta jhana or anapana jhana or kasina jhana. It's all exactly the same. So you can call it vipassana jhana, but it's still jhana, no different than all the other jhanas. Yes. Yes, the environment is going to change. One of the great things I learned in science is the future of our Earth. It's doomed. The sun is going to expand. And when that sun expands, it's going to subsume the orbit of Mercury. That's going to actually be within, so the sun's perimeter. And Venus is going to be go up in a puff of smoke, going to be vaporized, and so is Earth as well. So everything you've ever done, all the records of every human being's existence, whether you're Nelson Mandela or Nirmala Gelhenagi, you're going to be equal. No one would have known you existed. And all the great monuments, the Tower of Pisa, no, a pizza, it must be lunchtime. Tower of Pisa. Tower of Pisa, sorry. Or Stonehenge, or the pyramids, or Richard Court's bell tower. All of that is going to go completely away. Nothing is going to be left. So all the global warming, it's going to happen. It's just we're trying to put it off as much as possible. That's our duty. We're all going to be vaporized. It's a nice thing to know that it's all going to be just dust in space. One of the other nice things I learned about from science, it's a great little piece of science, is actually the way that elements are constructed. So because it all starts off with just protons, just hydrogen. But then, the only way you can actually make the bigger elements, you know, like the iron, you know, which is a lot of iron is in you, the only way that's made is actually in these cosmic furnaces called supernova. So I remember just, you know, in astrophysics, the professor telling us, and it's well known, that the only way you can get the elements such as iron, it has to be in two supernova minimum. So the hydrogen, the original material of this universe, some of it coalesced into this big slow sun, big star, and it exploded in this huge supernova, and billions of times the size, I think about 10 to the 10 or something, size of an atom bomb. Huge amount of energy going out. And some of that dust, only a fraction of it, coalesced into another sun, another part of the universe, and that also blew apart in the second supernova. And some of that dust was actually captured in the orbit of our sun, coalesced into the Earth, and some of that is you. So if you could ask some of the elements in your body right now their history, and if they had a memory, they would recall two occasions when they were in this cataclysmic, unimaginably powerful supernova. That's actually where your elements come from. I thought, that's really cool. Wow, you've been through a supernova, two of them. Wow. That's awesome. So, that's where your body comes from. You are literally stardust. I think that's said in the was that Hair movie many years ago when I was young. You're all stardust. Okay, so I think that's enough now. The interviews today, you've seen on the board there, but again, I have to go to a funeral today, not my own, somebody else's, and I'll be leaving about 10:30. So we'll see how many interviews we can get through. If it gets a bit late, the people at the end of the list will reschedule you for this afternoon. So please, I apologise if those at the end of the list today don't get quite on there, but sometimes, I mean, most times we can get through with plenty of time, but so give it a try and see what happens. Okay, and so have a nice lunch. I'm not sure what you're eating, but I'll be out for some lunch, and for a funeral, I'll be back this afternoon. So interviews this afternoon as normal.